Leaders Questions with Ger Gilroy and Stuart Lancaster.
In association with Goal.
From Off the Ball.
All right, you're very welcome back. It is another episode of Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. I'm Ger Gilroy and I'm here with you for the next bunch of weeks talking about the issues of leadership. Our guest this week is rugby league legend Kevin Sinfield. And I'm delighted to say he's with us today. Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so yourself and Stuart are kind of cut from the same cloth and that you're from the same part of the world and that you're both steeped in rugby. How well do you know Stuart and how did you kind of first get to know him?
Yeah, we're from a similar part of the world. We're both from up north. However, Stuart's a Cumbrian and I'm a Lancastrian, so probably some irony in the fact we both worked in Yorkshire for so long. But anyway, I first met Stuart when he was back in his playing days, playing for what used to be Leeds Tykes, and then quickly saw how he changed roles and progressed. And he was always a big fan of rugby league, always spent a lot of time chatting about different aspects of our game. And likewise, I always had an interest in rugby union. And very early on, I suppose, we hit it off and there was a friendship forged. But, you know, I've certainly been a huge fan of Stuart and Stuart's coaching abilities, leadership styles, but probably more so Stuart as a bloke. He's a really, really good man who has some brilliant values and morals. And, we struck a decent friendship and kept in touch ever since.
We'll talk about rugby league and your career in a minute, but I just want to kind of start the conversation by talking briefly about the brief transition that you had to rugby union at the end of your career. It seems from the outside that you kind of did it because it was an itch that you needed to scratch. It was like, well, you know, why wouldn't I try this? Why wouldn't I have a go and see if I could actually play rugby union at the end of a glittering rugby league career?
Yeah, it was something I always wanted to do. I thought to get the opportunity to play two professional sports is it just really appealed to me. I've always been a big fan of rugby union. Unfortunately, growing up, I'm from Oldham in Lancashire, and in fact, many of you probably don't even know where that is, but it's a typical working class northern town. And I didn't realise we actually had a rugby union club until I was about 19, so all I ever knew was to play rugby league. But to get the opportunity to go and play rugby union was, you know, was too good to miss. And yes, I was almost 35, or I was 35 when I moved across. The challenge was brilliant, and for the 7 months that I played and tried to learn the game, the friendships and the players I met throughout those 7 months are as good of friends and mates that I made in 20, 25 years in playing league. So I really enjoyed my time. I think sometimes you have to be out of your comfort zone. You have to challenge yourself and have the courage to make some pretty brave decisions. But I'm so glad I did it. It was very, very different, probably more different than I expected on the field. Going back and playing in the winter was interesting, and because it wasn't top level, some of the grounds and some of the pitches that you played on probably weren't at the standard that I'd been used to at top level rugby league. So it was a shift in mentality, but I really enjoyed it. Just the challenge of facing something new every day and getting used to not having to retreat 10 metres and getting used to actually seeing space but knowing when to attack it in rugby union. Because as you know, if you get isolated, you can lose the ball very, very quickly. So I'm really glad I did it. It actually helped in my transition from being a rugby player to I call it normal life. It certainly helped me in showing me that I could survive in a different environment. Now, I've been at Leeds all my career, so you're not quite sure what that next environment's going to look like and how you'd cope. And like I said, I really enjoyed it.
Stuart, we should at this point put a bit of context. Kevin is a legend of the game of rugby league and has had one of those careers where you can see the time and effort and energy and thought has been rewarded over a long period of time. That it didn't come easy, that it was like every bit of progression was fought for and thought out and mapped out. And that's kind of why he's such an impressive character.
Yeah. I think from my point of view, obviously I saw Kev come through. So my transition was from player to academy manager at Leeds, from academy manager at Leeds to director of rugby. And during that transitional period from player to academy manager to director of rugby, Kev was on his path as a player. And I was lucky to, we shared the same building, effectively. So Leeds Tykes and Leeds Rhinos shared the same buildings, and Leeds Rhinos were the premier rugby league team, really, alongside Wigan, I guess, around that time. Kev was gravitating up to leadership positions within the Rhinos team. And I remember one game, I was invited in by the coach to watch the game. And it was one of the games that the Rhinos lost, actually. And I went to the changing room after the game, and normally the coach would do the talking and everything else, but Leeds had a very, very strong group of senior players, or becoming senior players, talented players who'd come through together. Rather than the coach speaking, Kev spoke. Kev spoke to the group. He said, right, what do we think about this? You know, we didn't get our preparation right, you know. And Danny McGuire said something, Rob Burrow said something. And I was so impressed by the way in which the players drove the environment at that time. And obviously, during my career, I then, you know, spent time watching them, and then I went to England in 2007 as the academy manager, running the international age grade teams and everything, and obviously the England senior job. And obviously, I watched Kevin and the Rhinos go through the ebb and flow of professionalism, you know, winning some titles, losing massive moments, Kev making his debut for England Rugby League, and then going on to, you know, lead, and then obviously, you know, into Rugby Union. So, you know, he's had a stellar career, really, but it's been... ups and downs, Kevin, be fair to say, wouldn't it? It's not just been all good stuff. And that's what I guess we're interested in talking about, is that, you know, if you can give a quick summary, I guess, to the listener. So, you know, if you can just chart your career very quickly from player through to where you are now, then it'll help them understand what leadership roles you've taken and then what you've learned. We can talk about what you've learned, I guess, along the way.
Okay. Do you know what? I'm not going to give you the full from being born, but I think what's really interesting, when I look back on the teams I played and the teams I got made captain of, we talk about a lot of luck and fortune in sport, and certainly in rugby. And, you know, there was one occasion, and it might make you smile, but under-10s, I turned up for a Lancashire trial, and I'm this... a young kid from Oldham, and for some reason, I don't know what I'd had for my breakfast that day, but I just thought, to get in this Lancashire team, I need to make sure the players in around me are the best they can be to enable me to do my job. So I spent the whole of this trial talking, encouraging, trying to motivate people in around me. On the back of it, I got made Lancashire captain. And then for whatever reason, because those teams I was in were successful, when you move up to that next level, you just end up, by default, being given a captain's armband. And I think I was very, very lucky. But as I came through, I got made captain of the Rhinos first team at 22. After a barren period of not winning the championship for 32 years, or 31 years at the time. The year after, my second year as captain, we managed to win the grand final, which was the first in the club's history. And thankfully, we went on to win 7. I captained the club for 13 seasons. Throughout that time, we won 15 major trophies. My last couple of years as a player at Leeds, was fortunate enough to be under the England captaincy, which was brilliant. But looking back on my career, I honestly say, as I say it with a smile on my face, it's all because of that under-10s trial. You just get one thing right as a kid, and sort of my career as a captain was mapped out, and yeah, very, very lucky. Right place, right time, I think.
That's mad. That is mad. How much of the build-up to that trial do you remember? Did you talk to somebody in advance, like, what's my best way, or what do I have to do? Was there somebody helping you to realise that if everybody else plays well, you'll play well too?
No, I don't know. I think it was quite mature for my age. Now I've got an older brother who were very, very different. We're almost chalk and cheese, but that age gap probably helped me to observe, and he won't mind me saying, but learn from the mistakes he made. And I tried to put them into my own career and my own life, albeit I was 10. I think what really drove me that year in particular, I played rugby under nines. And this sounds really, really, that we're talking this far back, but under nines I played, and I was a sub. I remember being really hurt, the fact that I was a sub playing against Yorkshire, and I think that's why at that trial at under 10s I turned up and I thought, right, I'm determined not to be a sub this year. and how quickly that would turn around by just trying to motivate and generate people in around me to be better. I ended up being made captain of the team, and like I said, from then on, it just kicked off.
Did you get better at being a captain as time? Well, obviously you get better, right? Because no matter how good you are as a 10-year-old, you're probably much better as a 22-year-old. But what did you do, and when did you realise that this was something that you could do well, and that it's worth learning about, and it's worth asking other people, and it's worth getting advice?
You probably laugh again. There was never one moment in my career where I thought I'd made it or I was a great captain. I just wanted to be better every week and wanted to improve and find ways to be better. I think the team and where we got to, we started to win trophies, we started to demand more of each other, and we weren't happy with just being a 7 or 8 out of 10. We were striving for 9.5s and 10s out of 10s each week, and we didn't always get there, but the fact that we were determined to do our best and help each other was the key behind it. Again, I'll mention it, a lot of luck, and I was very fortunate that those teams at Leeds in particular that I played in, we had some tremendous leaders. And Stuart mentioned a couple of them earlier, but I'll mention a couple more. Jamie Peacock, he was Great Britain and England captain. We had the former Australian captain, Danny Badiris. We had a former Samoan captain in Willie Poaching. We had a former Ireland captain in Barry McDermott. So we had a whole host of different leaders. And I think to play rugby at the top the level, you have to be a leader. You have to have some leadership qualities anyway. And I think we were just really fortunate with timing. Really fortunate that we got a group of players who were desperate to make so many sacrifices for each other and go that one step further. And at times we knew it was going to cause some pain or make socially our lives be quite tough, but actually we were prepared to do it for each other, and you know, thankfully, as a group, and I say as a group because absolutely that's what it was, as a group of leaders, the majority of the time between us we got it right, and I certainly didn't get it right all the time, and I certainly didn't have the answers all the time, and I relied heavily on that group that were firmly behind and wrapped closely to me. But I think between us, we did our best, and ultimately that's all you can do.
One of the things that you talk about, Stuart, is making sure that you get your leadership philosophy straight very early on. How can people actually do that? What do you mean by that? And like, we can apply it to the fact that as a 22-year-old, success is already there for Kevin, but what do you mean?
So this, I guess, is in a coaching context, but the best advice I was given was, in order to be successful as a leader, you need to be clear on your on and off-field philosophy in terms of leadership. So your on-field philosophy in a rugby context for me would be how we'd structure our attack, our defence, you know, what's our philosophy of playing the game, are we a kicking game, or a kicking team, or a running team, or whatever. And the off-field philosophy is how you want to build the team, you know, the values, the type of personality you want the team to have, the type of mental toughness and resilience that you want to impart, the type of leadership you want to grow within the team. And I think, you know, a lot of people go into leadership positions without really having thought that through. And, you know, I was a bit like Kevin, that I gravitated to leadership positions during my career. But someone only told me that when I was about 31, 32. And what I'm trying to do, like I say, at Leinster, is pass on that to the younger players. So we've got, you know, great leaders. I think when Kev was 22, we've got now Gary Ringrose or James Ryan or these sorts of players. And I want them to be and have the success that Kev's had with the same, in the same style. You know, this is the team that went on to win the treble, which is virtually unheard of in rugby league. Clarity on your philosophy is important, and clarity, particularly as a coach, when you are asked to make decisions, it gives you a compass to help you with your decision making. So when you've got decisions to make, you know, you look inside yourself and think, well, what would my belief tell me here,
Do you communicate all that at the start, so that then when you do make decisions, if somebody doesn't understand it, you can kind of go back to first principles and say, well, you know, this is not part of our identity, you've stepped outside of that, and that's why I've made this decision?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, it depends a little bit on the team that you're working for. So with England in 2011, obviously it was a completely new team, and actually I got Kev and Jamie Peacock to come speak to the team. So I wanted people from other sports who could speak to the team, help guide them. But I was reasonably directive at that point about this is where I believe, you know, this is the way the team should be built. This is the way we're going to build the team. You're either in, you're out, basically. And I selected some players who I thought would be good role models and good leaders. Owen Farrell, these types of players who are now the leaders of the team. So that was really important. But when I came to Leinster, obviously a lot of this was established. They you know, we'd won the European Cup 3 times. We had great leaders that you know, Johnny, Sean O'Brien, these guys, Rob Carney, etc. And now it was my way of coming in without trying to change what was already there, but more guide it a little bit more to my philosophy, working alongside what Leo's philosophy is. Do you know what I mean? So I didn't, then I wasn't directive, I was more influencing and trying to change the shape and the direction of the team. So, you know, leadership is often not just about being directive, it's about influencing people, and it's sometimes subtle rather than obvious.
Yeah, of course. Kevin, I started by talking about the rugby union hiatus or holiday that you had, the short period of time you had there, because that was one transition, and you've already talked about how it helped you to transition to normal life. But then you transitioned back to being somebody who's involved in the running and the coaching and ultimately director of rugby, back where you have made your name as a player. It's a completely different job, and obviously you know that better than anybody, but how different was it? Like, and what were the things that kind of surprised you when you went to work for that first few months that maybe you hadn't anticipated?
Yeah, I'll just put you straight. It wasn't a holiday when I joined rugby union. It was anything but. But yeah, it was very different. I suppose coming back, I expected to find a very, very similar environment to the one I left, albeit I knew it would have evolved and I was hoping for the better. Given the run of results we had, though, leading into that period of me coming in, I realised something probably wasn't as it should be. And I found that pretty quickly. And I think the difficulty is trying to change some of the stuff on the field. And I know Stuart mentioned the difference between on and off the field, but trying to change some of those things on the field are affected massively by what players do off the field. And I think I saw a massive change in where we'd been to where we was when I came back. And some of it I didn't recognise. Some of it had changed massively. And I think probably the biggest thing I found was there was no real accountability. You know, whether that's from the whole rugby environment, just had stopped making each other accountable. And I think whenever you do that, I mean, that's not having, you know, a lot of policemen in around your training ground or watching people away from the club, but actually that personal accountability and that self-discipline to do what you need to do to be the best you can on a weekend. We'd lost some of that, but also the ability to call each other out and say, we're not accepting that as a team, we'd stop doing it. And I think we probably got tired of it. And you know, trying to change some of that has been really challenging, but I feel now we've got a new head coach in place in David Ferner, and he's given some real direction and on the field. And you know, my belief is that, you know, your head coach, your director of rugby, your CEO can give you a vision, but your players run your club, your senior players give you the direction to how to get to that vision. You know, our senior players have really stepped up now this year, and hopefully it won't be too long before we're back where we should be.
Can I ask how you go about changing that culture when you come in and you realise that it's not working and the accountability isn't there? What are the first things that you can do to make sure that that is a topic of conversation that everybody's having?
Start to make people accountable again. Start to make people understand the values, and start to make people understand how we are perceived externally, but also how we perceived internally. And I think it had to start with me at that time. I think you can say what words you want to say, but actually, unless you're prepared to live them, people will understand very quickly you're a fraud. So, you know, being very honest about what you do and how we go about your day-to-day stuff, but having some integrity about it as well, and making sure that you live a certain way and you set the lead. And how can you expect others to live better, cleaner lives and be more responsible for their performances on the weekend and be more responsible for their attitudes away from the club if you're not prepared to do it yourself. So that had to start with me initially. And then again, like I said, you just try and make people accountable, and you need to encourage and try and take your senior players on that journey. And then with that, try and educate some of those younger players who perhaps haven't been in an environment where I'd been very lucky to have grown up in, where a lot of these things have been called out and you'd been told when you'd stepped out of line. We needed to encourage that again and make it healthy and natural and organic. And there's a right way and a wrong way to point a mistake or something that doesn't fit with your values. There's a right way and a wrong way to point that out. And making sure we got those messages right so that actually people didn't take it personally but fully understood that it wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, that's a difficult enough process that you've got to go through in any work environment, because different people take the same message in different ways. Sometimes people do take it personally, and other people can fully just accept that this is all part of a process to make us collectively better. Is that something that is a skill set you have to acquire as time goes on, or is that something that you just kind of know from having been a captain all the way through your life, Kevin?
No, it's a really tough question, because I don't get everything right. I know I don't, and I don't always have the answers, and I'm not afraid to ask people. I'm not afraid to ask whilst I was playing a younger player for his opinion on something, or to get his advice on something. Like I mentioned earlier, I was a captain here for 13 years, but you know, at times I was very much a soldier as well, and very happy to be a soldier whilst other people were better at leading in certain areas than I were. And I think to empower that and to encourage it is really, really important. And I think it galvanises the group and gets them all on board. So in my role now, trying to find the right message to certain players or certain staff members, I might not be the best person to do that, but I'll go about trying to find the best person who would have the biggest influence on them and the right sort of influence. And it might be that two or three players or two or three staff members or a combination of both approach a certain individual in very, very different ways to make sure we box it off and make sure that the player understands or the staff member understands. And hopefully, I mean, that does take some time, but hopefully now it's quite healthy and organic, and people are happy to be uncomfortable at times. Our environment needs to be comfortably uncomfortable, if that makes sense. And that is a process, and we're building towards it now.
Yeah, the comfortable in chaos line.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I think Kev's touched on a load of points. I remember I came into a similar scenario when I took over Leeds Tykes in 2007, and Phil Davis, the director, had resigned. We'd been relegated from the Premiership, and you know, Leeds Rhinos didn't get relegated last season, but they weren't far off it when Kev came in, took over, you know, halfway through the season. And I think getting feedback about how you perceived internally and how you perceived externally, and I had I used this I think it was a criteria of 19 qualities of high performing teams. And I listed the 19, and I gave the players a sheet, and I said, right, I want you to mark us on a scale of 1 to 5 where you think we are on each of these criteria. So, you know, mutual accountability, you know, support, success, or whatever it is. And they'd score it on 1 to 5, and they all gave it to me. So I averaged them up, and I said, this is where we see ourselves at the moment, you know, and the average scores are like 1.2 or 2.1, or, you know, very, very few high scores. So of all these 19 criteria, and I said, you know, we have got some changes to make here. How do you think we go from where we are now to where we want to be? And that was the first step, you know what I mean? Getting the feedback, their internal feedback about how they felt the organisation was. I could talk from the outside because I'd come from the outside, albeit I'd been the academy manager. You know, Kev's come a little bit from the outside. He's come back to the club, but he wasn't at the club at the time, you know, during last season. So I think by raising the awareness of that, then you begin the process of creating change. I think the interesting thing I find interesting in sport, though, and be interesting to get Kev's take on it, is that analogy of a performance clock. I think we've talked about it before, where a team at its peak is 12 o'clock, and a team at its lowest point is 6 o'clock. And teams are constantly circling around this clock face. And the great teams who are winning titles and trophies, and you know they've got a young, vibrant leadership group who are on the field and a coach who's leading them well off the field, they're up around 10, 11 o'clock. And it's the great teams that stay 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. They don't go through the cycle of same players, same coaches, doing the same things, losing responsibility, losing accountability, losing games. The whole cycle starts again. All the senior players leave. Coach gets sacked. Start cycling at 6 o'clock, work your way back to 12 o'clock. You know, Alex Ferguson, you know, in his time at Man United, he would always have changed something at some point around about the time, you know, he felt it was getting stale or stagnant or whatever else. It might be a coach, it might be Keane leaves or Beckham leaves or someone leaves. And that's the art of it. You know, I think about Leinster. Leo and I talk about this all the time. How do we sustain success at Leinster? You know, we want Leinster to be successful in 10 years' time, not go through the peaks and troughs of all the way back down to 6 o'clock and start again. I look at, say, Dublin football team. You know, is it possible for them to win 5 titles in 5 years, but then continue to win 6 or 7 or 8 or 9? So, Kev, back to you, really. Just on that analogy, where do you think in terms of, you know, the life cycle of the Rhinos at the time, you know, you went... What was it you think needed to happen in hindsight, looking from the outside in, or even being on the inside, you know, around about that treble winning time when you left? You know, what do you think now when you look back at it?
Honestly, I'm sad.
Did you think changes needed to happen before
yes.
they happened?
Yeah. So I suppose myself, there was two other players who retired at a similar time who'd been around a number of years, both 36, 37, who were very, very influential within the group. And, it was the perfect time for us. And I think you read that now and again, or see that when a team does really, really well, they invest heavily when they're at the top. And I think we probably should have done that. We should have made sure that actually the players we brought in at that stage were of the best possible level to take us to that next step again. I also feel some responsibility alongside the other two that actually part of our jobs as leaders within that team were to make sure that the people that came after us were better versions than we were. And probably all three of us thought we'd done an okay job with that. Clearly we got that wrong. We may have took that for granted a little bit and expected more than what came after us. But yeah, there certainly should have been better investment and better recruitment in our squad, and perhaps in other areas as well, to really stimulate the group again and make sure that when they started that 2016 season in particular, yes, they were defending champions, but they were going to go and attack for it again.
That whole notion of being the aggressor, how do you maintain that? So in GAA in particular, in Ireland, if a team loses, automatically the analysis reaches for, oh, they didn't have the hunger. And, you know, it can be a bit lazy. But how do you actually maintain the desire that a team has who is at the top to retain its standards and the aggressive decision that the collective has made to go for something?
Really good question. I think that's down to your people again, down to your group. If you get the right type of people in with the right attitudes, who want to improve, who want to get better, who absolutely love winning and almost become greedy about winning and lifting trophies, I think they drive your group. I use the analogy of the time I played here in the best teams I played in, that we were like a seesaw. And heavily weighted with the down this end where my elbow is, were our players who had great values and morals and who would do whatever it took. No matter what happened, they were constantly driving the team. And then we had a group of players who were sat in the middle who were easily swayed by what the majority was. And then we had a couple at the top who were different characters and would often look for shortcuts or look to have a bit more fun on social events than probably what they should. Thankfully, I always felt the balance was heavily towards this end, The difficulty is when you lose a couple of these people from down here and the seesaw starts to tip, some of these that are sat in the middle are happy to go. And as soon as it tips the other way, it's really tough to grab it back. And that's why, and I'm sure Stuart has this at Leinster, that a lot of your recruitment now and your retention is around getting really good quality people in who can actually affect that seesaw and affect that balance and make sure actually your environment is one that can grow and improve and be better. And they're not happy just winning one trophy. They want two and three and four and five, and they want to leave a legacy behind. And thankfully, throughout my time as a player in Leeds, those players who were at the top of the seesaw never seemed to lasted longer than two or three seasons for whatever reason. They just got moved on. And I think we probably need to get back to some of that.
I'm interested in a little bit about. So one of the things that Leinster have is that so many of the players come through the system, and Leinster is their team. I mapped the distance from Oldham to Leeds. It's an hour, so you kind of, I don't know if Leeds would have been your team growing up or not, but it seems like you certainly identified with that cause as a teenager when you started going up there, and it became your team. And you've now, obviously, you're a one club man, a lifer at this stage going back. So how important is it to have a fundamental belief in the cause of what you're trying to do? Because professional sport is just a job, ultimately, and yet the ones who succeed somehow find something else beyond it being just a job.
Yeah, I just think your pathway players are so important to your club. Those who understand what the club is built on, they understand where it's been, they understand what the present day is, but they also have an eye on the future and understand what it should look like. They understand the sacrifices of some of the players or key personnel who've been a part of that club for however many years before them. My journey to Leeds, like I said earlier, I was an Oldham boy, and things have changed significantly now in the sport, and rightly so. But I signed a professional contract at 13 at Leeds. At that time, played the majority of my rugby over in Lancashire. So the famous Wigan, your St Helens, your Warringtons were all fishing in the same pond for players within that sort of northwest region. I was a ball boy at Oldham for 3 years, my hometown team. They didn't seem to want to sign Oldham boys at the time. And it was just a chance meeting with a Leeds scout that I ended up at Leeds. But very, very quickly, what attracted me to the club was the fact that they had a clear eye. Perhaps they were quite groundbreaking in the fact that they really wanted to promote young players. And they saw the real value in pathway players and promoting people from within and having a good succession plan. And that never changed throughout the whole time I played at the club. Our core group of players came through together. Then you sprinkled in some world-class players from all over the world, and we got a pretty strong team, but our core was always Leeds pathway players, and we've probably gone away from that a little bit, but hopefully that is a big driver for me now to ensure that the quality of our pathway players is where it needs to be, but also that our team is full of local lads. And Stuart, and you know, having been a fan of Stuart and watched the great Leinster team over the last couple of years in particular, the number of core players, the number of pathway players that Leinster produce reminds me very much of a Man United back in with the class of the 92, or, you know, I don't want to compare it to our lot because we're not in the same league as Leinster or Man United, but actually our group had a similar fundamental drive to push through local boys who grew up together.
I think you saw that, right, when you walked in and you were in the change room that day and you're watching the players drive that. It's like a group of players who understand each other to the point where they have shared their teenage years, where it's kind of constant, you didn't do that thing, you were supposed to do that thing. Let's, well, like that, and that's a really remarkable thing, where those players have the talent and skill sets. The class of 92 is the perfect example, that they're actually good enough to drive each other on as opposed to just mates.
Yeah, I mean, the way the Rhinos built their success and the way that Leinster is built is very, very similar. You know, when I started as academy manager at Leeds in 2005, I wanted to go and see the best academies in the country. So I went to Arsenal, and Liam Brady was there, and I quickly worked out that they're the best academy because they're the most money in the ball, like loads of overseas or young players from outside the catchment area. So I didn't really, I got a lot from it, but not as much as I thought I would. Leicester Tigers had a very good academy in rugby union. Obviously, they were now our rivals, so they weren't so keen for me to go. But actually, the best academy was right next to me. It was Leeds and Rhinos. And that group of players, that Kev played with, they were all just making that transition at 18, 19, 20, 21 into the senior team. And they became the core of the team. So very much a homegrown team with a couple of, overseas players. Absolutely the same as what Leinster has right now. I had a visitor in the other day, and he came yesterday, and it was the Blackrock St Michael's game in the school's cup. So he watched training. He's from a school in England. He watched training. He says, "How many of these players have come from the Leinster area?" And I said, 95%. And he said, "These two schools that are playing, how far are they from here?" I said, "Well, one's 1 mile and one's 2 miles away. And you've got 5,000 people watching these two schools go at it." I mean, it's phenomenal, the identity that Leinster has and the number of homegrown players. And then you bring in a James Lowe or a Scott Fardy to add to that, and you've got your senior players. And obviously, I'm very, very mindful of not having just this senior leadership group of Johnny, Sean, Rob Carney, et cetera, et cetera. It's about the growth of James Ryan, Gary Ringrose. So when these boys leave, which inevitably they will over the next 2, 3, 4 years, we don't end up in the Rhino situation where when Kev leaves and Jimmy Peacock leaves, there's a hole there that never gets filled. So, the more that these young players speak in meetings, the more I encourage them to grow as leaders, the more chance Leinster have been to be continually successful and not go through the dip that maybe Kev's having to pull the Rhinos out of.
Yeah. Yeah, Kev, I mean, obviously it's a huge challenge that is going to be a long-term project, but the building blocks of that are to try and get back to the core values that you spoke about. I'm interested in where your own core values come from. Because you talked about people will see you as a fraud if you don't live the values. You kind of need to have got those values right in the first place.
The club was always built on a couple of values. The club's always had great humility in success and defeat, I think. And it's always been prepared to... the players here, no matter how good they've been, they've always been prepared to ask for help and advice and support when it's been needed. And I think within that, humility can be quite powerful in galvanising a group and a team. The team has always worked incredibly hard. The team trains, every club thinks they train hard, but I always felt that some of our players were prepared. We had a number who would train on Christmas Day, for instance. Now, we were out of season at Christmas time, but would purposely go out and train on Christmas Day, not for any other reason, as just to try and get an edge on the opposition and just to keep that discipline and make us tough and hardened for those big moments in games. I always felt we had a real honest group with a lot of integrity, and we made tons of mistakes, but we probably weren't as honest as what we should have been. But I felt during that period we were more honest than most other teams, and that's what got us through. We believed in it. It got us through in big games when it was tight. We knew we'd put the work in, and we knew we hadn't cut any corners. And then probably the biggest thing is just being able to sacrifice yourselves to put the team first. That's so important. If we all have the mindset that the team is the most important thing, and sometimes you have to cop one on the chin, sometimes you have to be left out, sometimes you have to hold your hand up and say, "I'm probably only about 60% fit here, so someone can do a better job." To have that honesty about putting the team first has been key for us. And that's come over time. That's come through from lads before me, that's come from lads who come through the academy alongside me, that's come through my whole career, but certainly something that we're trying to grab hold of and firmly put back in place at the club.
Rugby league seems like one of those sports that hasn't quite yet been corrupted by the way that a lot of other sports have been corrupted by TV money and And maybe this is a completely romantic and completely erroneous viewpoint, but it seems more like it's a way of life. It's something more akin to GAA in Ireland, which is actually amateur, that it is something that is about a cultural identity as much as it is about sport, that ultimately you may all punch the head off each other when you're playing each other, but that off the field, you realise that you're ultimately the same people trying to come together as a community and celebrate your best athletes while at the same time being able to enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'd probably point out at this stage that we quite like to be taken over by huge broadcasting company. I think the sport, you know, would thrive with further investment, especially with participation. I think that'd be crucial for us going forward. But yeah, I think what that is, the beauty of rugby league is it's always kept in touch with the bloke on the street, and it's enabled players to be able to mix with kings and mix with people on the street as well. I think that's really important. Rugby players, and I'm going to include rugby union players in this as well, are pretty down to earth. The majority of them come from good stock, and you don't meet many bad eggs in rugby in either code, I believe, and they have a healthy respect for each other. The vast majority are good people and try their best, and I think that's what makes rugby of either code so special. Now, you know, if I bring it right back to and look at rugby league in particular, I'd probably say 95% of our players will have to work after they finish playing. So some of them might have a 15 to 18 year playing career at top level, but we still have to get a job at the end of it. Rugby union probably slightly different. Certainly football is, a lot of other sports are. So within that, it firmly keeps your feet on the ground, because you have to prepare as well for life after rugby. And if you treat people like dirt, then you won't get any opportunities when you finish. And actually, that isn't how we should behave as sports people either. We, you know, I think we have, we should be motivated to make sure that the people that come after us are better than us, but also try and encourage people to be healthy and fit and genuinely good people. And it sounds like I'm living in some crazy utopia, but actually, you know, we can all make this place a little bit better for each other if we try a little bit harder. So, yes, I'll stop waffling.
No, it's interesting, because that's your value system. Does that come from your parents? Is that where you got that?
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah, I think you're massively influenced by the people you grow up with. I've had an older brother and an older sister, and I'm, you know, I was, like I said, a typical working class family. Friends as well. You know, your friends and your peers are so important growing up that you're in and you're with the right group. I was pretty lucky that, having played rugby from the age of 7, my best mates were rugby players. And I suppose had a similar view on life as I have. I had a fantastic rugby coach growing up who just instilled so much discipline into us. And we knew very, very early that what was acceptable and what wasn't, and what's right and what's wrong. And yeah, I probably missed a large part of this conversation. We've not even mentioned fun, have we? You've got to enjoy what you do. You've got to enjoy trying to be the best you can be. And you know, I think within that, although rugby is quite a tough sport and a physical sport, you've got to care about your environment. You've got to care about each other. And you know, that's why I go back to being fortunate and being very, very lucky in the right place at the right time. Because for whatever reason, our group of players, our group of staff, all felt similarly towards what we're trying to achieve.
There was one last thing that I just wanted to touch on before we let you go, and that was dealing with setbacks. The stuff that we've talked about had been your successes, and it's an amazing, glittering career with fairly relentless success with Leeds. But there were obviously setbacks along the way. There were games lost. There were moments where things didn't go your way. Did you get better as you were a player at dealing with that, or do you begin to realise that these chances won't keep coming? You know, in retrospect, were you not that great at dealing with them at the end?
No, I think I got better at dealing with them. When I first started playing, the peaks and troughs were huge. And I think through experience, through having a family and a couple of kids and understanding actually when I got home from a game that I'd not played well in or we'd lost, that actually there were things that were far more important in my life. And I devoted my whole career to being the best I could be on a Friday night or a Sunday afternoon. But actually the realisation that, my sons weren't bothered whether I'd played well or not, weren't bothered whether I'd won the game. They just wanted to see Dad. And like I said, just through experience, you get better at dealing with it. Don't get me wrong, they still hurt. There were still those moments where you just want to be swallowed up or you wanted to lie in your bed and pull the covers over your head. And there's still all those moments that everybody has. But, I found out pretty quickly that the longer you stay in bed, the longer you have those covers over, the tougher and the harder it gets to face those problems. So, pretty quickly learned to deal with them and accepted them, and they were part of sport. And I never enjoyed those moments, but I suppose they helped make me the person I am today. There was plenty of disappointments. There's plenty of really, really tough times, but that's probably when I learned the most about myself.
Yeah, and also about how to deal with them now. Like, ultimately, if your career is one straight, very straightforward victory after victory, then maybe when it comes to dropping somebody now or firing somebody or any of that kind of stuff, you don't really have the experience or the emotional intelligence to be able to do it properly.
Yeah, exactly. I think it helps. I think my biggest asset in this role now is I can remember exactly what it's like to play. I think the minute I lose that, probably similar to Stuart, I think when you're fortunate to get a role like this, to be able to put yourself in other people's shoes and understand how they feel and how your decision or your reaction will affect them is key to this. But I think when you're able to do that, it certainly helps with some of the decisions, certainly helps with some of the choices, but it doesn't make it any easier making those decisions. You've still got to make people accountable and you've still got to be the guy who makes the decision that puts the team first.
Yeah, we were talking about making choices and divides the room.
You decide, you divide. Mm. generally, if you get the right culture, the right environment, the right leadership, everyone understands why it's done for the betterment of the team. And, that's what you're striving for, as a leader, to create that environment. Not everyone's going to agree, but ultimately it goes back to if you want to be the manager, then just be the manager. Organise the schedules, organise the weekly, whatever. But if you want to be in Kev's position, you want to try and grow the organisation, you're trying to improve it, you want to try and get back to winning titles, then ultimately you have to make decisions based on what you believe is right. And if you shy away from those decisions as a leader, I think you're storing up problems further down the line. You might save yourself a difficult conversation one day, but I guarantee you're storing up a bigger one down the line.
Yeah, no doubt. Kevin, it's been great spending some time in your company. Thanks a million for making yourself available.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Kev. Thanks.
See you too.
See ya.
Kevin Sinfield there, the rugby league legend who's currently the director of rugby at Leeds. We can't overstate how big a legend as a crossover star in rugby league Kevin is, the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, which is a massive deal. He finished second in it to Andy Murray, I think the year Andy Murray won Wimbledon. And he was the first time that a rugby league player had ever been nominated. So you can kind of see he was like an emblem of an entire region, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously from a UK perspective, rugby league is still a smaller sport, if you like. It's played more in the northern part of the UK, of England, than anywhere else. So for him to achieve second, in the sporting personality, it was incredible and a great testimony to his achievements, the team's achievements, but his achievements to help leading the team, there's no doubt. And your comparison between GAA and rugby league is a valid one, though. Even though it's a professional sport, it's a working class sport, really. And it's all built around communities, and it's built around Oldham and Wigan and St Helens and these little towns and on the M62 corridor they talk about. Kev Kev in that world is highly regarded everywhere he goes by not just the team he's represented, by every other team. You know, he's captained his country, he's worked in that environment, he's gone to rugby union, which was a huge, it's like, I don't know, a hurling or going to play football or whatever, or a footballer going to play rugby.
Yeah. I think that was interesting because I think that's the type of stuff that he's storing up information that is going to be useful, even just the way he was talking about attacking space. Yeah. And so, like, our experience in Ireland of rugby league has been, did Mike Ford come from rugby league?
Yeah.
And Les Kiss came from rugby league.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how, Mike Ford was Ireland's first ever defensive coach back in the year 2000, I want to say, or it was around that period of time anyway. And so we've kind of always had this interest in how the two sports compare. And I think there's always been a realization of the value of it, but.
Andy Farrell?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, there aren't many bigger rugby league legends than Andy Farrell.
Yeah.
I mean, him going to rugby union was huge, huge news. You know, Andy be held, like Kevin, in the highest regard in rugby league.
Yeah, and so you can kind of see why rugby union looks to league for information and for that kind of...
Well, rugby league obviously split from rugby union because the game went professional, you know, about 100 years ago. So they've been professional sport for... Rugby union went professional in 1995.
Yeah.
So there was always catch-up. You remember where the cross-code challenge, Wigan played Bath. And, you know, had this fantastic Wigan team. Wigan turned up to the Rugby Union Sevens and won it. Wigan Rugby League.
I didn't know that.
They were so far ahead.
Yeah.
In terms of professionalism and the quality of the players. And
is it still happening? Are you watching rugby league games going, oh, I see what your defence is doing there?
Oh, yeah, all the time. So, excuse me, I would watch... I've just downloaded the wide view of the Castleford game from the weekend. They scored 40 points, so I'm interested to see how they... I know Daryl Powell, used to work with him in rugby union. How's he constructing their attack? You see a lot of rugby league in rugby union across the board, defence and attack.
Yeah.
People like Kev, they stand out to me. And Jimmy Peacock was another person he talked about who was an unbelievable captain as well at Leeds Rhinos. And as I say, I brought both of them into speed to England rugby union in 2011 and... I was pleased I did.
Yeah. All right. Good stuff. Sure. That's another episode down. This week was Kevin Sinfield. You can get the podcast of that wherever you get your podcasts. offtheball.com/podcasts. Good stuff. We'll be back next week.
Leaders Questions with Jer Gilroy and Stuart Lancaster.
In association with Goal.
From Off the Ball.